and welcome to Mr. Fadu Bukom, who is a senior economist in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, shortly referred to as OECD. You'll wonder why, especially those who are not from this region, why we as the management decided to call OECD. Our rules always following the constitution, which allows us to summon any person to appear before the committee. It gives us that authority to do so, to give evidence or produce documents. I leave out that aspect that is with own affirmation, because they're not summoning in that way. It's just summoning for the purposes of empowering ourselves. What most of these summons would do, or calling or requesting institutions to give us their presentation, this is because our rules also requires that committees could collect any evidence that would increase and help in increasing the work that the committee should be doing. That is bringing clarity to the work that we're doing. That's the essence of it. Allowing committees to definitely discuss more issues elaboratively, unlike what, because we don't have the time to do or an opportunity to do that internally. So, robustly discuss issues within the committee, so that by the time we reach plenary, for whatever reason, we have the insight and more understanding of issues. It also allows members to develop expertise and in-depth knowledge of that of the committee's work or the area of work we are assigned. Because our meetings are observed by the public, or they are open to the public, that then gives an opportunity for members of the public to interact with us individuals on the issues that have been debated in the meetings of the committee. Therefore, increase the level of participation of the public, and also the representation of the public by members of parliament, what we call constituency representation. It also allows the rules give us says this opportunity of getting information from institutions. It allows us as representatives of parliament to hear evidence and collect information related to the work of our committee. So these are some of the reasons why we should from time to time call people from various sectors or institutions to come and present to us, so that we can have that type of information for to better the work of this committee. And if we do so, then we are also helping in empowering Parliament, because as a committee we need to be experts actually in the work that we do. So this type of engagement with the institutions like OECD will help us in doing so. So it is with honor and great appreciation then for us to welcome Mr. Baligo. Four. I understand you flew from Paris. That's how serious you take Parliament of the RSA. And we really appreciate that. We normally have a way of welcoming visitors. And I know we welcome them the South African way. That is by cutting our hands in appreciation of their presence here. Can we do that? We're going to give an opportunity to Mr. Falilo Form Paul to present to us the work as he requested, just to give us their brief on the work in the in terms of South African socio-economic issues. We know we get such issues from locally, which is from various institutions in South Africa. But it sometimes helps to also get it from an outsider, some person who's just observing from another level, so that we can be able also to see whether what we think we are really pushing, that is the part which we're trying on, is still in order, or are there areas that perhaps we fail to look at deeply and must understand that we're all doing that for the benefit of our people. Without a waste of time, let me introduce the members of this team. We have, I'll start at my far left there. A gentleman, he doesn't have spectacles today, I don't know. Mr. Atkinson, he's representing the Democratic Alliance in the committee. The next to him is Dr. Kado, who is also representing the Democratic Alliance, in the team. And then just crossing over there to my right hand side there is Ms. Mbata, representing the Economic Freedom Fighters in the committee. And then in the middle of the of this room, guiding us from the door, is the whip of the committee, Mr. Chile, representing also the African National Congress in the team. And then the gentleman with the four eyes is Mr. Diani, representing the African National Congress in the team. And then we have next to Mr. Bikinini, which is also representing the African National Congress. We have Mem Ranto, also representing the African National Congress election. We have, I think, other members who are not here, who will be joining us, I guess, in short time. Do you have apologies?
No, I wish to put in the record that we did not receive any apologies for this meeting.
So from members of the team, there are no apologies, meaning that members might be joining us in due course. May we then introduce also our supporter so that you know who to communicate with. Thank you. Communicated already with Peter Paul Mbele, who's got a future of the team. Then on my right hand side is our researcher, Ms. Nwabi Sambelegani. I always forget services. We have our contract assistant, that side, who is just behind Dr. Kado, Ms. Tabiso Lekage, and then my PA, that side, Ms. Venetia Williams. Others are the guests but not really yet, because the PMG there is helping us with most of the time taking notes and also communicating decisions where possible. Yeah, that is it. May I then give this opportunity? And I'm Mrs. Coleman. I forgot. The chair of the committee. May I then give you the opportunity to address us or to brief us on the work that you're doing with respect to South African socioeconomic issues. Over to Mr. Falilolo Force.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable members, thank you for inviting us to brief on our work in South Africa. I'll go directly to present first what is the OECD and what we are doing, and then and how we are doing it. Then I will briefly present the last year South African survey we did, before coming to the inequality and poverty in South Africa, how we analyze it, and then I talk about policy reforms, growth, and jobs. I go quickly on education and skills before finishing on minimum wage discussion. So the work I will present is a work carried through OECD directorates. It's a work from the economics department, but also work from other directorates, from our education directorate and our employment and labor social affairs directorate. So first, what is the OECD? So the mission of the OECD is to promote policy that will improve the economic and social well-being of people around the world and member countries and partner countries. The OECD has been founded in 1961. Originally, it was formed by Western countries, and then it gets opened, and now we have 35 member countries and key partner countries, so where we have a strong relationship with those countries that are not yet member of the OECD, Brazil, China, India, Indonesia, and South Africa. So they have a special status, they can attend all meetings, all committees, and participate to our work, and we do survey for the countries as we do survey for member countries. So the functioning of the OECD, so this is an international organization which is different from the IMF and the World Bank. It's different from the IMF and the World Bank in the sense that we are not a bank, we don't have money, we don't lend money, we don't finance it. Our only asset is policy advice we are giving to countries. Policy recommendation, policy advice. So it's an international organization set up to help countries design policy, better policies. So we have a council which is constituted by the ambassadors of member countries and headed by the Secretary General of the OECD. The current Secretary General is Mr. Angel Gurria. So, and under the council we have the committees and what we call the secretary. The secretary is the group of the different directorates we have. We have 12 directorates. We have, for example, the directorate on tax policy, which is currently very well known, working on tax evasion. We are in the front line of tax evasion and the fight against tax evasion by multinationals, for example. We have directorates on employment, labor, and social affairs. We have directorates, the economics department, where I'm from, and we have the committees. In the committees, we have the permanent delegations that are represented in the committees, in some committees, and in other committees, the member countries send people from the capital, in general from the different ministries, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Health, Ministry of Foreign Ministry, to attend those meetings and discuss the work we prepare, the directorate secretary prepare and present to the committee. And sometimes some of our work or recommendations, there is negotiation around it and it becomes international treaties or international charts that the conference follow, accept and sign to follow, and therefore there is peer review between countries. So how we work, the OECD is known to work called data collection. The first dimension of our work is to gather data and to compare countries and to look at what is working, what's not working, and how countries are performing, and then to draw lessons on the success of different countries. One well-known data collection we have is the PISA test. PISA is a well-known education test on education achievement and capacity of people, and it has had a lot of impact. For example, in Germany, when they saw their scores in the PISA ranking and test of countries, then they say, oh, we are not doing well. We have to reform our education system. And then we work with them to reform the education system. And in France, it had a huge impact when they saw that they're decreasing in the ranking in terms of PISA, in terms of capacity and of the pupils and the students. So that's one way. So we gather data, we analyze them, and then we present that in the committees. We discuss them with member countries. They can agree, they can disagree, and sometimes turns into implementation and peer reviews and multilateral surveillance. So we have lots of publications. We have the economic outlook. We publish twice a year. We have the economic survey. So as I said, we do the economic survey for all our member countries and key countries. And we have a Going for Growth, for example, which present some policy recommendations for countries. It's the annual publication, for instance. So here's briefly what is the OECD issue. So I'm going to give an example, present briefly our last survey for South Africa. We launched it last year in July with the Minister of Finance. And the survey is, we do it every 2 years, so we are currently working on the 2017 survey. We hope to finalize it and present it in July, and we will be happy to come here and present it. So this survey, we do a general assessment of the countries, the macroeconomic issues, the long-term issues, and then we already do two special chapters on two thematic issues. So, and though we go deep on those issues and we come with some recommendations. So the 2015 survey, so first of all, what we can see is that the social progress has been impressive. So you don't have the whole of finance. So social progress has been impressive in South Africa in the last 10 years. You know, you can see that households without access to private water has diminished. The households without access to electricity from the grid has diminished. Absolute poverty has declined, and social grants have increased a lot. However, in the last 3 years, you can see that GDP is falling behind. And if you compare to other emerging countries in the same context of global crisis, South Africa is a little bit underperforming, and 2016 number is not much better. And why is that? Because of different bottlenecks to economies. One important one is the electricity generation, where you can see that it has declined in the last years. Everybody knows about the power outage in the country. And also bottlenecks in different areas, in some in the port sector, where the cost of the port sector are one among the highest in the continent. And also some lack in some road and transport infrastructure. Those bottlenecks are binding the capacity and the growth of the economy. Another factor driving those low performance is also the social relations, which are somehow still difficult. Wage negotiations are too confrontational. And you can see here when we calculate the working days lost due to strike action, and those have impact on the economic activity. But we presented our work at the NetLab Commission last year, and we had a fruitful discussion, and it seems that general agreement that there is a need to improve the at least the framework of the negotiations to to get to success and to negotiate and be success without to confrontation. So another dimension also we've added is that growth has not been increasing enough. You can see that the youth unemployment rate is the double of the unemployment rate in this figure. And also you can see that the share of the income going to the top 10% is much higher, like more than 50% of the revenue going to the top 10%. It means that you don't have the benefit of growth accruing to everybody in the country. And this is a driver of inequality also. We will come back to that. So also one driving force of inequality is also the working age population that has jobs. Here you see that less than half of the population has jobs. So the unemployed, the discouraged people, the inactive, all other categories of inactive are representing more than 50% of the working age population, which means that they don't have a direct income, and therefore it's a driver of inequality also. Another dimension which now has impact on activity, on creation of activity, is the barriers to entrepreneurship. SMEs face too many obstacles, and here we use our indicator from our product market regulation indicators, and we see that South Africa is among the countries that have a high barriers to entrepreneurship. You only have other emerging economies that are having higher barriers to entrepreneurship. So more advanced economies try to diminish those barriers to entrepreneurship, and we'll come back to that later. So that gives a flower of the survey. We go further in details in the taxation issues in one of the chapters, in the infrastructures competition in the other chapter. And those are the key recommendations. I mean, we summarize them very briefly. I think three, four of them just to discuss them. One is the electricity. We think that it's important to increase the independent producers in the production of electricity. And there are processes to do that. We think that there needs to improve those processes and to accelerate them. And to do that and to have that, we need also to set up prices that reflect costs. We know this is a sensitive issue, I mean, the price of electricity, but if you want to increase the productivity and also the level of electricity, you need to have prices reflecting costs, otherwise you won't have private producers getting into it. So there is a balance, but electricity is really, I mean, important to have production going on. And if there are other ways to subsidy low income people capacity to pay electricity than through the price level. You can do it through transfers, you can do it through other means, but the prices need to reflect the cost so that you can have more price. And also the ESCOM needed, because an ESCOM has to do the maintenance of the grid, has to invest in capacity, has to increase the production of electricity, and the only way they can do it is through getting prices reflecting their cost. Another we can discuss is also the wage negotiation. We think that there is a room to have a mediator that can assess the demand and also can discuss with both parties in negotiation, say, okay, what is reasonable, and can tell naturally the truth to the corporate and to the union so that you can bring all parties into an agreement base. You know, it's something that in some countries is working and help to solve strike actions. Which are the one I would to this, maybe this employment service. And we think that there is a need to, and it is, and the Labor Department has started to do this centralization, building public employment offices that can get the information and improve the matching process in the labor market between job seekers and firms. Because there is a cost to have the information on job opportunities. There is a hiring cost, and one way to diminish that is to have those one-stop shop for job seekers. Another important issue, those are related to expand affordable public transport and build housing closer to economic centers. This is an important issue. You have some settlement areas which are far from where the economic activities are, and therefore people are paying a high cost in terms of time in commuting, in terms of cost of transport to go to work or to go to look for a job, etc. And we think that you need to expand affordable private transport to support that, and also try as much as it is possible to build the housing close to the economic centers. That's a very important urbanization policy. And, so I leave that there for the economic survey, and then I'll now go to the inequality and social and South African labor and the South African labor market. Here, the first thing is that there is a deep labor market divide in South Africa. It's by ethnic background, by gender, by age, and by education, and all those dimensions are concurring to the inequality in South Africa. First of all, by ethnic background, you can see that the unemployment rate of black Africans is the highest one, above 25%, while it's less than 5% for white people. So, and this can you see in the other dimension, this is a driving force of inequality in the country. Second, employment here also, you'll see that between women and men, there are fewer women than men in paid work. Oh, if you see for South Africa, it's not the worst, the difference between men and women. You can see that in Turkey it's much higher, in Mexico it's much higher, in India, in Indonesia too. But still, if you compare to more advanced countries like Norway, like Sweden, the difference is much smaller. So there is room to improve that. And also what you can see that here is South Africa has the lowest employment rate among all those countries. So there is, first of all, the inequality issue is, first of all, an issue of access to job. So enough job created and access to job. Youth unemployment, as I said, you know, have like 51% of youth are unemployed, so this is a big driver of inequality. And youth, this is a young country, so youth represent a bigger share of the population than in other countries. So also there, you can see that the only countries that are in that level are Greece and Spain, that was very hard hit by the crisis. And Spain unemployment rate went up to 24%, for example. So, and the other element is what we call the people that are neither in employment nor in education or training. We call them NEET. And this is, you know, have one third of the youth that are neither in education, in employment or training in the country. And this is a big part, and it asks for directed policies to reach the people and bring them back in the labor market and in the training system. I talked about that later. Also, informality is not the highest. It's important that if you compare to other emerging countries, it's not among the highest one, but it plays its role in terms of inequality also. So all the labor market inequalities are reflected in the earnings. So as you can see here, you have the differences in terms of earnings between men and women, between the different ethnic improves using skills, and you can see that the skilled people are learning much higher than low-skilled people and smart-skilled people. And those are the driving force that are feeding the inequality distribution in the country. And to a large extent, those labor market inequalities reflect inequalities in skills. Here you can see the school attainment by the different groups, and you can see that also the school attainment of white people is much higher than for the all other groups, and so that shows that where the target should be in terms of better reaching and targeting the education policies and investment in training. So, but what we call extreme poverty is relatively low compared to some countries, and also thanks to the social grants policies, extreme poverty is relatively low in the country. So, why do we care about rising inequality? Because we found that higher inequalities lowers well-being and can mean hardship for those at the bottom of the distribution. Because we also care because we've seen that inequalities lowers economic growth. Inequality is not good for growth. We don't think that inequality is good for growth. We think that it's the tying low end of the distribution in a trap which prevents them to participate in economic activity, and it can have an impact on low middle classes. And so this is not good for growth. This is not good for education investment. This is not good for productivity. And we found that using redistribution tools and transfers to tackle those inequalities can be helpful and is not impeding growth. So that's one of our main lessons. And so we are not among those thinking that redistribution policies is all too bad for growth. I mean, it depends on the level and the degree, but up to some point it has to tackle inequality and guide growth, and it's bad for growth at least. So how can those labor market disparities be reduced? As I said, unemployment is one of the key drivers of inequality, so you need to promote stronger and more inclusive labor markets. This means getting more people to work, improving job quality. And here it means you to do that through first appropriate macroeconomic policies. I come back to that. The first thing you need is to create more jobs, more growth, more jobs, and through that then tackle barriers to creation of permanent and informal jobs. So I took to those growth later on how to boost growth. In terms of improving the labor market, we think there is room to improve job quality. There are too many people which are low paid. That's one issue here. And you can see here in this table, in this graph, that the average earnings is very high compared to other countries because of the earning inequality. Because of the top 10% having a very high income and revenue, that brings the average earning high. But it's not going to the whole distribution. It's concentrated in the upper end of the distribution, and then you have many people that are very low that have very low wages. And this is where you need to have policies that tackle that wage distribution to lift everyone. You need also to reduce what we call labor market insecurity. It's coming essentially from this extreme low pay, which is a kind of labor market insecurity, and which you, as you can see here, is very high for in South Africa. So to tackle this income inequality, what we say is that, so you need to build this stronger and more inclusive labor market, and for that you have some potential instruments. Those potential policy instruments are government transfers and also some tax provision. And do you think there is room to increase, to tax more top income households so that you can do more transfer, so that you can reduce inequality. But you also need them to have a better service delivery, better delivery in terms of education, better delivery in terms of healthcare coverage, healthcare access, provision of healthcare. This is important so that when people pay tax, they agree on paying tax because they have the value for money. And that's one way of building the consensus and the willingness to pay more tax. So it's very important to invest in human capital. And South Africa has been investing a lot in education. The problem you're facing is very, very difficult. But it's now more a matter of the quality, the design, to increase the quality. I'll come back to that issue. So first, as I said, the inequality is more about, and the income issue is more about creating more jobs. And creating more jobs is, to create more jobs, you need more growth. More growth so that you have more economic activity, more firms running through the economy, creation of more firms. That's the only way you can have enough jobs for all individuals. You can try to create some jobs through public services, but you'll never be able to create all and to satisfy all the needs through public jobs. And the only way to satisfy this job need is through economic activity and creation of firms and jobs. So to do that, we have a tool to look at the impact of different policies on growth and job creation. So we have this channel of transmission of policies to GDP per capita. We usually, the driving of GDP per capita growth of is through employment rate, capital stock, and what we call multi-factor productivity. And then you have the different elements that that have impact on those dimensions, that is innovation, trade policies, labor market policies, education. And then you have all the policies, the different instruments you can use to affect those dimensions, and therefore employment rate, capital stock, investment, and productivity. So how do we measure those instruments? We divide them into different categories. You have the product market regulation instruments, you have the labor market instruments, you have the tax and benefit instruments. We have other various measures like education, innovation, agriculture and energy policies, etc. And we build, it's where we really build a data collection to measure those policies and therefore to measure the impact of those policies in the economy. So one data group of data set we have is what we call the employment protection legislation, where all the variables, we try to measure them, we compare countries across those variables, and but those are very high measure of labor market policy. It has to deal with the procedural inconvenience, it has to deal with severance, notice and severance pay, it has to deal with the difficulty of dismissals. All the dimensions, we measure them, we compare countries, we try to figure out how they affect labor market performance and how they affect GDP and growth. And we estimate the impact, basically we do econometrics around it, and to estimate the impact of those variables. The other group of variables are the product market regulation indicators. This is a survey we run every 3-4 years across all OECD and key partner countries, where we measure all those dimensions of regulation of markets. And this is one of the most important dimensions of policy for government, because it has to deal with how you, as a government, do impact the markets, goods and service markets, especially. One way is to say, okay, we're going to, as a government, try to do everything, to do the investment, to deliver all services, and stuff. But guys need a high amount of revenue to do all this. The other way is to, in some areas where the private sector can do it, to say, okay, in this sector, I need the private sector to do it well. What do I need to do so that the private sector will do it well? What you need to do is regulation. Is regulation. Regulation. And those regulations, you can do it by creating regulators or by having Department of Government monitoring those markets. Where, why do you need a regulator instead of government department? It depends on whether the area is well developed, you have enough competition, you have the private sector that can do, that can deliver. Therefore, you don't need to have policy interaction there. You can, as a government, set an independent regulator with objectives very clear, that is to, for example, make sure that the companies are doing the right investment level to make sure that capacity is there, that there is no cartel there, that the prices, the people that have access to the service with reasonable and decent prices. And if the, those objectives are clear, you can have an independent regulator to, that will oversee those aspects and do the job. And you change the people every 5 years, for instance. Or, and we advise countries to do those, to set up those regulators. We advise them in areas where the objectives and the conditions, the economic conditions are very clear, we help countries to set up regulators. So we measure those regulatory policies and we look at how they impact the economy. Here is one example, which is the barriers to competition. And here you can see that for South Africa, you see it in the right-hand side, the barriers to competition are still high. They have decreased between 2008 and 2013, but where it is relatively high is the state control and also barriers to entrepreneurship. And here you see that state control is still important, and one of our advice in this survey is in market areas where there are enough companies, enough private companies, enough competition, you need less state intervention and more regulation. One example is, for example, telecommunication. In telecommunication, you can have a very good regulatory policy to make sure that you have a coverage of the country, to make sure that you have good quality of service, prices going down, and without public money. Public money is rare. You need public money for other services, you need it for education, you need it for health, you need it for other, so you have to trade. So why use public money for telecom? Why you have to deliver on education and health? Why you can use private money for telecom? You better use private money for telecom by regulatory policies instead of putting public money. That's the kind of recommendation we have on that. So on average, we see that the labor market policies that high tax wage, high unemployment benefit, lower spending on active labor market policies tend to have negative effects on labor markets. And for what we call framework conditions, so the competition policy and institutions, positive effects comes through rule of law, judicial independence, competition law and policy, and financial development. Those are important for positive impact on market development and market outcomes. Negative effects come from barriers to trade, investment, and entrepreneurship, and also housing market regulation. We often forget about housing policies. Housing policies are very important to have good economic outcomes. And we have tried to estimate the impact of reforms in South Africa. We started to look at public market reform, and some reforms would have a very high impact is would be through reducing administrative burden, government involvement, in particular in rural sectors. In terms of labor market, there is some some policy in terms of automatic extension of wage agreement. So the idea is that here to do that with some deep look on sectors. We're not saying that don't do extension of automatic agreement, but look at the sectors where you do the extension, how they impact those sectors, and then you can choose pick between them where to do those extension of agreements. So we have so other recommendations can be seen in this economic survey for South Africa and in this publication policies on growth across. I go very quickly on education and skills because I think this is, and I mean, we have all the elements there, and so I'll come to a minimum wage discussion for finishing. So the education, as you know, is playing an important role in the economy, and it is a very, very important area for South Africa. We've done a special chapter on education in our 2013 economic survey. We've done this skills beyond school review for South Africa, which was done by our education directorate going through education. And all I'm going to say, what I'm presenting here, is from this. And this is available, I mean, the electronic version is available. I don't have copies because it's from our other directorate. And we try to be green, so we print them, as you see. So, and as we know, the challenges are to improve the basic education. It is also the quality remains poor on average and even across region. And that is here one of the biggest challenges is the people with a low background or more people need more resources, need more investment in terms of education, in terms of infrastructure and quality of teachers. And that is really an area where policies should try to bring to those people the most and the best on education so that you increase and the potential gain for the country and the economy as a whole is high. Because if you give a lot to people, to well-off people, the potential of increase is low. And if you give more to low people, the potential of increase is higher, and the impact for those people and for the country is higher. So, but as I said, South Africa has been investing a lot, and you can see in this graph the progress in the last 10, 20 years. It has been important. There is still a need to progress. Coming from a lower level, it has been a tremendous effort, I mean, to in that area. So our main recommendations, I'll do on basic education. We are to improve teachers' training, and I think the first one I wish to put here is, as I said previously, is to bring more means to those who have the most, I mean, the biggest needs. So there is a need to the allocation of education means has to be think about again to bring more quality and quantity to those. Then there is a need to improve teacher training and enhance accountability and monitoring of school leadership. And we think that the school leadership is, and we saw that in the different comparison we do across OECD countries, school leadership is very important for the results at the school level. So you need to give to school directors more power in terms of monitoring the professors, in terms of monitoring their presence, for example, in terms of monitoring that they are following the program and etc. and to reach some results. We think teaching English as a second language earlier would increase also the education performance, upgrade the infrastructure, and also gradually phase out school fees in public schools then, because those also are easy, it's not working very well. So the other on vocational, we need there is a lot of work that has been done, and the bringing vocational in the Department of Higher Education has been a good move to try to have a more unified policy in that direct dimension. And we think that here also there are some need to reform the funding scheme, not in particular the levy grant and the TVET college funding formula, so that to have better results there. I did not give up that, but just wanted to mention the two elements. Now, so for education, as I said, we have all the work we've been doing, and we have it also, and we can discuss it. So let me turn to the minimum wage before concluding. There is a discussion about introducing the national minimum wage. So the primary goal of minimum wage has been to help workers with low bargaining power in the labor market. But there are also other objectives surrounding minimum wage introduction. It's about labor standards, it's about reducing inequality, it's about poverty, reducing poverty, it's strengthening work incentives, and also increasing tax collection. So one needs to, when you are setting a minimum wage, one needs to choose and pick between those objectives, which are the one you were targeting, because this will have an impact on the way and the level you set the minimum wage. And one important question around minimum wage is the question of insiders, the trade-off between insiders and outsiders. Insiders are people already in the labor market having a work, a job, and outsiders are unemployed people, some unaged people, or people in education, or very low skilled people, and you already need to trade off between the gain from people inside the labor market and people outside market for when you set up a minimum wage. Another dimension is also what we call in economic terms a general equilibrium effect. It means that when you set up a minimum wage, it has an effect on the labor market, but it has an effect on demand, and therefore it has an income effect, which is going through the whole economy. And so it's always very difficult to disentangle precisely the impact of minimum wage, the positive and the negative impact, because of the general effect. But key factors in setting up the minimum wage are the level, variation, coverage, method, and transition arrangement. I'll go through quickly. The first one is the level. So in OECD countries, typically, minimum wage is set at half of the median full-time wage in general. In most of the, it's like, I think, in 18 out of 26 countries that have minimum wage. Also, one issue with minimum wage, in particular in emerging countries, is the impact on informality. One has to take that into account because it can push some people into informality and increase the level degree of informality. The variation. In some countries, there are different minimum wages. For example, there is minimum wages for youth in some countries, in half of the OECD countries. Why are they doing that? Because when you set a certain level of minimum wage, and you have young people who have just finished their education or who doesn't have education, their productivity level is low compared to an older worker. So if you pay them directly to the minimum wage, you risk to have the company not recruiting them at all, because they say their productivity is not up to the level of the minimum wage. It's not worth for us to recruit them. So if you want the company to recruit the people, the youth, and give them the experience, so you set a minimum
minimum wage, a low minimum wage for those people, so that so in South Africa it may be difficult because youth are a big part of the labor force. So then you need to think about that, but you can supplement the minimum wage with other social grants. It can be in terms of access to housing, it can be access to healthcare coverage, and etc., which will increase at the end of the day the level of income they have because of that. Another dimension is regional differentiation. In some countries, you have differences in terms of minimum between the different regions because the cost of living is sometimes very low in some areas. So companies in those areas can't afford a high national minimum wage, so you do those kinds. Another thing is the frequency and the method of adjustment. This is very, very important because of once you set the minimum wage, you need to adjust it regularly because the economy is growing, wage is growing, productivity is growing. So how do you do that? In many countries, they have an independent expert commission that will review mostly every year the increase of the minimum wage. We look at productivity growth, wage growth across different dimensions, and will advise the government on what they think is the suitable increase of the minimum wage, and try to do it without any political interaction, so that it is acceptable by all parts. And also, transitional arrangements. In the initial state in Germany, they provided them with some exemption for some branches. So you can see that the variation of minimum wage across OECD countries here compared to average wage, to median wage and so. And here also is the impact of tax and transfer policies on minimum wage, because when you set the gross minimum wage, then the take-home pay will depend on employees' social contributions and also will depend on income tax. And you can see here in some countries can have a high impact on the take-home pay. Hungary and Latvia, for instance, they set the minimum wage, and at the end, what people can take home is quite low. Is quite low. So one dimension people must take into account when setting minimum wage is how it impacts different age groups. You see that the youth are mostly more impacted than the older workers in the first panel. In the middle panel, the low skilled are much affected than the upper skilled individuals in terms of also type of contract. Temporary workers tend to be much affected than people with open-ended contracts. Also, there is an experience in the United States minimum wage. You can see in this graphic, for example, Greece started with a very high minimum wage and it has decreased over time. France had an issue with the minimum wage in around 1997 when they introduced the 35-hour work per week. Then there you had this increase in the minimum wage. And this increase in the minimum wage has yielded a quite important increase of unemployment rate. And so what they're doing now is to introduce a lot of tax exemption, tax rebates for employers that hire people at the minimum wage. And that creates problems somewhere else because you reduce social contributions for employers, so then you're missing that money to finance healthcare and family policy, for instance. So it's really, one has to take a comprehensive framework when setting this minimum wage. So we have here many lessons that one draw from OECD countries and partner countries experience. I think I've been much above the time allowed, so I will leave there and we can discuss those issues in the question and answer session. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. I think this was quite comprehensive, and I think we have a better understanding of how OECD sits South Africa in the global frame. Of course, we're not yet a member of the OECD.
If I may, you are most welcome.
Okay, I think you know where this belongs. At the moment, we appreciate the fact that we are engaging with the OECD in South Africa, hence we are able then to access our policies and so forth and information, and you are able to give us feedback on what you think South Africa needs in order for it to be on a correct developmental path. Members, this is the presentation. We really need to make use of this opportunity. I know that many of us have questions. Most of the time we ask ourselves various questions relating to the research outcomes of the OECD, and we most of the time are left with questions more than answers, and today is the opportunity for us to get the responses from the mouthpiece of the OECD. May I be interested in the discussion by show of hands? Ms. Dutchinson, Ms. Mbata, Ms. Lian, Ms. Mazimbi, Dr. Kado, Bob Pini, in that order, please. Did you raise your hand? You didn't. Oh, sorry. Ms. Dutchinson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the support for a very interesting presentation. The point that you make, Richardy, is that the only way really to increase the income of the general population is to improve education levels. I just want to ask you specifically about tertiary education, about whether you've done any studies on tertiary education, the funding of tertiary education, the desirability of free higher education, because obviously we've been taking money away from other places like maybe basic primary or secondary education. So this is the OECD's view on the funding of tertiary education. And then the second point, or the second question really, is you make a point about the desirability of increasing taxes on higher income earners to increase social spending. I was just wondering about any surveys you might have done about the negative effect it might have on total tax receipts by increasing income tax rates. But also the whole issue about the contract between the citizen and the state, tax morality, and the efficient spending of money, because obviously in every country the citizens pay their taxes on the understanding that money will be spent efficiently and correctly. And what we see in our country is a very, very high spending on education, but our education outcomes are amongst the worst, according to World Bank surveys. So is it desirable to tax more and get more money and necessarily throw it after something that doesn't appear to be particularly efficient, or should it be a focus on the quality of the education that we're delivering? And then the final question is...
I longer love three for now. Can we have the last one you raised and a follow-up? Each member, please, the limit of three questions. Babu Mbata.
Good morning, and thank you very much for your presentation. My first question will be, have you studied the impact of VAT to the ever-declining standard of living, in particular to the lower income earners, and the fact that they have become a force mainly dependent on what you called the basic food basket. And the basic food basket currently is the one that is bringing more taxes to the fiscal, precisely because of VAT, which means we're getting more money in collection from the people that we should be least expecting money from. Two, the hardening stance of the unions in South Africa has reference to inequality, which means the widening labor market and society has created pain to the organized unions to an extent that they are no longer trusting on the private sector or the employers, and as such, the forever explanations on their poverty while the employer executive takes bonuses that are ridiculously high has also referenced the prolonged inequality. And then the last one, since the chair says we must stick to three, the poor in South Africa spend 60% of their money, the working poor, spend 60% of their earnings on two items, precisely because of special apartheid development. They spend their money on transport, and they spend their money on food. Have you maybe looked at considerable relationships between special planning and inequality and factors such as food prices or rising food prices? In this instance, with due respect to my addition, the relationship between the developing countries, or maybe there could be a relationship going down the ladder to countries that are similarities.
Thank you, Mbata. Mbata-chan.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Falk, for a comprehensive presentation. My three questions for now are as follows. We are very encouraged by the position that the OECD is taking in recommending to South Africa to gradually phase out school fees and so on, because this, in a way, also contributes towards reducing the inequalities in the country. From your experience, Mr. Ford, what would you say is your experience of the impact of private schools, like in a developmental state like South Africa? That's the first question. You correctly also encourage the use of more independent producers of electricity to increase capacity, but this is necessary for industrialization and so on. But what would be your view, Mr. Ford, say for instance, this was really to increase to a very, very high level, where you have the most of the major companies in the country now producing their own electricity and not utilizing electricity from the state-owned company like Eskom. Would that continue to be a positive, or would you think that it would become a negative? And lastly, the OECD believes that our wage negotiations are very confrontational. I would like to know, comparatively speaking, what would you say is the situation in other similar countries like South Africa? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to thank you for the presentation. It was really an eye-opening, and it gives us more
more information, more than what we thought we will get out of it. Thank you very much for the presentation. I just wanted to add on what Honorable Ian has just said on the IPPs. ESCOM in last week in its presentation in their presentation, they said the IPPs in the South African market creates uncertainty about our future role in the energy sector. I just want to add on what Honorable Glenn said. Does that mean if we go the IPP route, we will be using less energy, and will that take us forward, or we will have to mix the energy and also use the IPPs as energy distributors, or yes, as energy distributors to our grid and to the nation at large. The other question that I would want to ask is on the issue of I did not mark clearly my picture, but it's only one question that I would want to ask. It's in the acquiring or the inequality that reflects on our skills. I looked at your drawing at your graph on page 23. I compared the Black African and the colored. This slide talks about the highest level of education attained. Here in South Africa, we have people that have not attained highest qualifications in their skills, but they have almost better skills than those that have got higher qualifications in those skills. For example, there's a story, it happens on the issue of the heart transplant of Dr. Barnard, that Dr. Barnard did. The person who helped him, it is said that he was sort of guiding or advising, but he was never mentioned in the history of Dr. Chris Barnard's transplant operation. He had no skills. He had no education, but he could advise a person with skills and with higher education than him. Hence, the transplant was a success. So I was checking. It's not as if I'm discriminatory or I am racist, but in the issues of blacks, which have less or more skills because of their education than colors, in my knowledge as a South African, I know of more colors with more skills but lesser education than the blacks, and they are more employed than the blacks that have skills, that have the education. So I just wanted to check if you haven't come across such information when you did your research. The last one is, what is the impact of grants in our communities to deal with the inequality and the interest of people acquiring education to have more skills and education and this? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. I think let's really welcome the deliberations or the input. You see, Chair, there's in page 43, there's an issue of casual fees, out school fees in the public system. Your comment, I think, is very clear on that one, that it's not really helping. You see, we do believe in our policy that we are moving towards free education. We are using a primary one as a startup process for going further to really achieve the free education even in SRE where we can. But the issue of resources that we do deal with. In the same page, you raise a matter of focusing on the quality of teaching, which I think is very much critical and important. Now, I'm sure the really question in that one is the issue of managerial skills through their leadership. I think which is required more. The last one, you see, I want to take it better one than to make the others, but I think I want to say that, you know, the type of studies that we had in South Africa, they are not really linked to job opportunities. Like, for instance, our focus on our government now is through infrastructure development. And then when you look at that, you look at the fewer engineers that we're having in that particular field. So we're not having that straight jacketed approach that will assist our country to move forward in terms of having jobs. Thank you.
Any further questions from members? Other members haven't spoken, is that? Those that have not spoken. Dr. Kado, I forgot to. Oh, yes, I missed you in the loop. I don't know how.
Thank you very much, and thank you to Mr. Paul for a very interesting presentation. I was very glad what you had to say in support of independent power producers, seeing that they seem to be under threat from ESCOM at the moment. But my questions relate to the Public Employment Service and to the National Minimum Wage. On the score of the Public Employment Service, I just wanted to know what evidence from other developing countries you have to support the idea of its usefulness. The reason why I ask is that a parliamentary question last asked you to our Minister of Labour, who stated that roughly about of the 618,000 unemployed South Africans registered with our Public Employment Service, only 14,000 odd of those people had actually successfully been placed in employment, which translates to about 2.3% of those registered having found employment. So it doesn't seem to have been a great success in South Africa in its current form. And then secondly, I wanted to know whether the OECD has had any formal input into the deliberations around the national minimum wage in South Africa thus far. And if so, what level would you recommend pegging the national minimum wage at? And the reason I ask is because that some research has shown that if you raise the minimum wage or you set a minimum wage of 6,000 rand, that could lead to some 65,000 job losses and push up unemployment rates to about 26% on the strict definition by 2020, with losses particularly in textiles and steel and those sectors that are already under threat on the job business front. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Kadu.
Dr. Kadu? No, thanks, Chair. Just one question. Where does OECD get its funding? Thanks.
Thank you. Is that all? Yes, I have a okay, thank you very much. I know there are many questions, I know that you are much more capable of responding, because it shows that members were listening very attentively. But I also have questions, unfortunately, to add on that. Just as questions of clarity, you referred to FA in your chat on page 13 as ZAF. F, what does F stand for? Just for public.
This is our way in the OECD to, when we do those charts, we try to put a reduction of, I mean, I can't tell you it was there like that when I joined, but it's how we do for South Africa. So, it was there, I mean, 4 years, but I will notice that that's not maybe something preferable for, so. But I mean, this is the official way we do for all countries.
Oh, okay. So, no, I just wanted to understand that F, what does it stand for? My questions would be around I'm sorry, I have to take all the questions so they somehow make mine disappear. You said South African government must not capture the market, sort of, if I were to put it that way, through its interventionist policies, but rather should regulate and let the market do its own work. If government assists the regulatory bodies, you see that as capturing the market, but you don't see the private sector financing as capturing government. I just want to understand how you reason on that issue. Secondly, I'm happy that you mentioned that the poverty has been alleviated in South Africa, meaning that, and you just mentioning that is through social security provision. And I'm just worried because to me it says you don't consider other interventions that the government has made to alleviate the poverty status of our people in the country. I just want to understand, because as you proceeded with your presentation, you sort of agree that the other kind of interventions that South Africa has made, is making the lives of our people to be much better than it used to, albeit with those difficulties that you still find, coming across. But that doesn't come out very clear, because my worry is if they don't come out clear, then it leaves a picture as though the government is not doing much in that area. And yet you acknowledge that there's been some areas that we've really done our best, especially when it comes to education, even though you mentioned that due to qualitative issues, we are not impacting that much in the transformation of the lives of our people. I just wanted you to talk more on that, because yes, when you look at the different trusts, it's very clear that you're comparing us with the, you know, with the developed countries, and yes, we're not yet there. We still strive towards that. But then when we look at those that we feel we're equal to, we see ourselves as doing very well. But that doesn't come out very clearly, you know, so that we give that kind of a distinction between who we are, where we are, and those that we're moving with, and how best are we within the group that we're supposed to be compared with. I think in so doing, you sort of encourage, because the reason why we get so much elation sometimes, I have a feeling, and also from our own people, is because we compare so much with those that are well advanced and have been in the play for quite some time, forgetting that we're just a new baby that is still trying its best to learn the ropes. I wanted to talk to the issue of to give the name of the person who was there. I just asked my researcher here to give me the name. Hamilton Nagy. Hamilton Nagy, Blancho, is the one who assisted Dr. Barnes. He used to do operations or to perform heart transplant on animals, specifically dogs. When they have a problem, they would transfer blood from one dog to the other like that, you know. And that's how he managed to assist Tapanat. That's a very, very important thing to mention when you look at state of development in a nation. And I think the issue that Meranto raised is very, very critical, especially looking at our history in South Africa, where blacks, I was looking at that a chart, and I was saying to myself, but when you look at the whole thing, you may think the category of white is doing well, but you don't look at the numbers. Because sometimes we tend to look at things in a very different way, and I'm a bit worried. Then their numbers compared to the numbers of blacks, I'll just put the black African to the white in this chart. And if you were to compare the numbers, I think you would come to more or less the same conclusion. If we were to look at the difference made between 1994 to date. I'm not trying to justify anything here, but I'm just saying sometimes it helps to put things into perspective, so that at the end of the day, we don't just put statements that would give people a particular interpretation or impression that would also leave a lot of question marks. I would have loved to do what Honorable Mbatha was talking to say. It was important also to go with time, that between this period and this period, this is also taking into consideration the history of everything. And let me also not capitalize on the fact that I'm a chair and ask more questions, but I just thought I should just get clarity on some of those things, and then perhaps explain. I know the method you did indicate here how you come to the conclusion at the end of the day, but my appeal is that during those discussions, it is important, because we are very sensitive and very maturing nation that needs everything to be captured in a way that would also begin to clarify where we're coming from and where we're heading to, because in that way, it will put a correct picture in the minds of people. And perhaps maybe to talk to all researchers to perhaps begin to be doing that instead of just focusing on numbers, because numbers sometimes can be deceiving, whereas whilst they are very helpful, but they, if not properly put or properly contextualized, might also lead a different perception. May I then hand over to you for responses? My apology to our next presenter. I know that we seem to be taking a lot of time on this. It is very necessary that we clarify ourselves on the various publications that have been made, especially on the analysis of our socioeconomic conditions in South Africa. Mr. Fox, may I hand over to you?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify some points and respond to the questions. And I will start where you end up, which is the directions. And I think what we try to say with this chart is, and we are not at all denying the trajectory and the efforts made since 1994. I think there was tremendous progress in many directions, and you are coming from a special situation which makes the way difficult, very difficult. And you can see it in education. There is a lot of effort, but where you come back from a background where 90% of the population did not have proper access to education, and you try to include them, it raises difficulties of any sort. Building the infrastructure, having the quantity of teachers, the quality, and packing that in the context of a dynamic growing population is not easy. We are not saying it's easy, and we're not saying there were no efforts in that regard. We are trying to say all those efforts have been made, but there is still a way to go. There is still a way to go in terms of quantity and in terms of quality. So I just don't want that at the end of this session, people think that we are saying that nothing or enough has not been done. We're saying there was a lot that have been done in terms, for example, in terms of housing policies, building houses. But the demand is so high that we keep on running after the demand. That's very clear. But it's very hard to always present, cross-cutting presentation of the picture comparing to other countries and the cross-dimensional dimension. So we try to focus on the cross-cutting to say, okay, now here's how you compare to the others, or here today where we stand. It does not mean we are not taking into account where you come from. So let me get back to the questions in order. The first question I get was from education. Tertiary education, and there was two honorable members referring to free education, etc. I mean, the OECD doesn't have an official view of the funding of higher education, but what we can say is that there are many dimensions you take into account. I think we at the OECD, almost for all OECD countries, primary education is free. That's key. Secondary education tends to be free in almost all countries. You can have competing private sector to the public sector. Why do you have competing private sector to the public sector? In general, it's for two reasons. One is
if you have a poor quality in the public sector. The second reason is if you have a very competitive environment, like a very elitist system, then upper class and upper middle class will tend to put their kids or their local performing kids in private sectors, so that private sector will push them because they will have more money and more focusing on those kids to put them to keep being in the elitist system. You know, you can see in countries like, for example, France, where you have a very competitive sector, where you have free public education and very good free public education at the secondary level, you really still have private schools there where the elite will put the system, their kids, so that they perform better, because the system is very elitist. So, in the context of South Africa, the development of private sector education is linked to the quality issue we have discussed. Because of the difficulty of building a quietly new educational system, the quality is not there. You will have as a kind of natural behavior, which is parents love their kids. You can't prevent parents loving their kids and wanting the best for their kids. So they will try to put them on the private sector. So if you raise the quality of the public sector, and the public sector is well-funded in its role, why a parent would pay such amount of money to put his kids in a private sector, why he can put it or she can put it in a public sector? So I think that it has to be seen as a quality effect, and so a need to improve the quality of the public sector, and then part of the private sector with certain disadvantages here. On higher education then, so before you go, just to answer to your question on the funding of the OECD is mostly funded by member countries. Member countries pay contributions, and those contributions are the main funding of the OECD. And then we have, when we do additional work for countries, they, what we call voluntary contribution, they contribute additionally for those views or specific work we do for that. No private funding at the OECD. So, on higher education then, it depends on the system in a different country. You have countries where you have private higher education, like the U.S., going with a small or relatively major public sector, not free on average, but public sector less expensive and higher than private education. And other countries like some European countries where you can have some free higher education. But the global tendency is that some parts of higher education has to be not free, as people have to pay for them, because first of all, it's expensive, it's very expensive, and government can't afford it anymore all the time. And second, the return of higher education is important, is high for individuals, and in general, when you go above the bachelor degree, the first 3 years, the return for the individuals is higher than the returns for the society. It doesn't mean it doesn't have a return for the society, so that people can afford and pay for it. So if people don't have the money, you have the grant, you have the loan system. You can think about those schools so that people, in general, if someone has a master's degree, he will most likely will have a job. He will most likely will have a good pay. So why should the society at all, and especially the poor people, pay for his master's degree? So this is how we tend to think about it. I'll try to go quickly on other dimension.
Yeah, I mean, the higher tax rate and the contract between students. I mean, the question is just, I mean, it has to deal with the wage distribution. The wage distribution is, I mean, what we've seen in the data is this 10% of workers having 50% of wage, total amount of wage, it's high. And it is creating problems in many countries. In the U.S., it's part of the discontent you can have in the country, and in many countries it is. And we tend at the OECD to say one way is to have companies having better regulation to avoid those kind of wage distribution, and the other tool is taxation. The impact of VAT on basic food basket. Basic food basket tend to have low rates or exemption in terms of VAT in general. So the impact is not clear because most of basic food items, they are not VAT taxed at the normal level. And VAT is, I mean, it has a distributional impact in general, a negative distributional impact. Poor people in general are more affected by VAT, but it also has an economic advantage. It's a less distortionary taxation tool than other taxation tools. So you have to trade off between the two dimensions, the distributional impact and the distortionary effect of other taxation tools compared to VAT. Inequality and union position the confrontational stance. We are not saying that there is no reasons to have strikes or to have unions shouting out. We are saying that the way it is done in South Africa, even compared to some emerging countries, is much confrontational. And that is having a very negative impact on the economy. It has an impact on political uncertainty and on confidence and on investment, and therefore impeding growth and job creation. So we think that there is a way to solve and resolve those issues in a less confrontational manner. And that's what we are advising. And it would be good for everyone. That's what we are saying. So, yes, gradually facing school fees, we think at the primary school level, as I said, it's a good idea. And the point is that to bring more resources where it is much more needed. So on the role of independent producers in electricity. So there are different dimensions to analyze this thing and the impact on ESCOM. There are different dimensions. One is production. One is distribution, access to the grid. One is the role of ESCOM. Whether ESCOM is buying the production from the independent producers and then sending it to everyone. And you can compare to other African countries where you had this power outage. Everywhere you had this power outage, you have big companies that can't afford to stop functioning that invested to produce their own electricity. Because it's very costly to close or to have the electricity going every 2 days and etc. You can't plan on nothing and etc. So therefore, if they start producing them in general, it's a higher cost than what the public company will do, than ESCOM and etc. And that has been true in every country. Because if you have a small generator, you buy oil at the market level and etc. and etc. In general, it's at a higher cost than the public sector. So whenever the public company comes back and is able to deliver in a trustable manner electricity without outage, in general, in many countries, they stop, the big companies stop producing their own electricity
and they come back to green. And that's the kind of self-production for self-consumption. That's different from the independent producers we are talking about. Independent producers we are talking about is electricity companies that invest on electricity center like ESCOM and that have the capacity to deliver megawatts and that they can sell to ESCOM, for example. That means that, what does it mean? It means that, and that is, this is true for this sector or in many sectors, because if ESCOM has to do all the investment of its own, it means a lot of money that ESCOM don't have or doesn't have or government money. And you know, there is this competition on government money. So it's a way of dividing the investment. That's all you can have. Public entities, private entities investing to provide part of the electricity needs. And therefore, then there is the role of the regulator, which will set the price at which they sell to ESCOM and the price at which ESCOM is selling to everyone. See? So you increase your production because you supplement ESCOM investment by private sector investment. But to do so, you need to guarantee to those private producers a buying price from ESCOM that is competitive in a way that they don't lose money. If not, they won't lose the investment. And it is working in some countries. In Senegal, for instance, they did that, and it's working. Even some international companies came and invest to build the central and sell electricity to the national company.
I need to follow this up because it is very important. Just you said it is one of the hindrances towards economic growth. What would be the other side of this? The flip coin of that. Especially in relation to transformatory issues, because competition issues.
Then there is a relationship between ESCOM and the private producers, and in between you need the regulator, which can monitor the real cost of production of those companies and fix a prices where they don't lose money, they have some profit, and still it's worse for ESCOM and for the final consumer because those private producers tend to have lower production costs than ESCOM. It's where you have the benefits for everyone. If they produce electricity at a higher cost than ESCOM, there's no need to have them. If they are able to produce electricity bringing in private money, then it's helpful and it helps and everyone is benefiting from the line. They will have profit and the final consumer will have a benefit because we will have access to an electricity with a lower initial.
I'm not talking with relation to the consumer producer. I'm talking in terms of producers themselves. That is the new entries to the market, those that are established, which you call investors, and, you know, balancing the two, that, and also the issues related to competition. Because, you know, you're saying ESCOM has to play that role, but at the end of the regulatory role, but then at the end of the day, it has also, in our case, to intervene in order to take into cognizance or to introduce also transformatory issues within. So I wanted you to talk to those issues so that we don't want monopoly at the end of the day because role players in some of the cases, especially in the case of what you have put as an example, tend to be very few and tend to be externally outsourced. So that is where the challenge, I think, might be. Hence the initial request that perhaps when you do this analysis, we should take, you know, into consideration some of these factors.
Yeah.
But I want you to talk to that so that we get clarity in a solution, a possible solution.
Yes, it's not ESCOM who's being the regulator. It's NASA or a regulatory body, different from ESCOM. Therefore, this one is in between the producers and ESCOM. Second, it doesn't have to be everyone who wants to get in. You can do it in different ways. You can do an auction and say, okay, I want a sensor of 60 megawatts. And I do an auction, and you have those investors, those private producers, they compete, and you award this to one provider. And then you can say, okay, as ESCOM, I want to have a capacity of 1 million megawatts. Through my mobilizing all my resources, I can produce 600,000 megawatts. I need 400 more megawatts. Then I can divide that into different auctions and award that to other independent producers so that I can reach the amount and that I need. That's one way of doing that. And then in between that, you have the regulators who is monitoring that. ESCOM is not benefiting from its position at the expense of the private producers, or the private producers are not benefiting from their position at the expense of ESCOM and taking into account the final consumer's interest at the end. That's kind of... it's not clear because here you have an issue with the price you're setting. Yeah, and the price you're setting today is not guaranteeing that it's worth investing in the issue. But we have a competition directorate. We work really in the issue, and we can assist in thinking about it and designing the system. Then if I go through the other one, the impact of trans on inequality in education and the impact of other policies on inequality in education. First, we are saying grants tend to have positive effect on education here in South Africa. And the social policies that have been put in place, most of the assessment we've seen is that they have a positive impact on education. Second, on inequality and on education, we are not saying all the well-being improvement is from grants. We think that grants play a role, but the other policies, as I say, the education policies, the housing policies, all those policies have a positive impact. The problem we are facing here is that the demand keeps on growing and the government keeps on running to offset the legacy of history and to provide for this growing demand, which is a very difficult task. So, on education and labor market mismatch, this is a difficult question, and it's very difficult to try to have an education system that is tackling, that is following actual policies, because by the way the people get out, you may be developing another policy. No? It does not mean that education has been disconnected with economic needs, but you have to think about more in a medium and long term perspective, and give the right incentives and information to individuals to make the right choice when they choose their fields of education, and etc. And you can, in the supply side, you can also have policies saying, okay, it is more open in that area and more close, or there is more competition to get in that area, because at the end of the day, the jobs, the perspective in that area is more restricted than in other areas. Public employment services impact and correct. I mean, the impact of public employment services, it has to measure in a area where you don't have enough job creation. You can have the best public employment services, but if there is no job, they can't find a job for the people. It doesn't mean they are useless. They are useful because they bring information, they can help people to train and to choose their training, and they also can push people to keep on being active in the labor market, in searching in the labor market. So, for the national minimum wage, we don't have any recommendation, specific recommendation in terms of the level of the minimum wage. All what we brought here is to say, you have to first think about what is the objectives of minimum wage you are trying to. Is it to reduce, to empower low skilled and low empowered people, or to fight poverty, or etc. etc. And if you think about that, you have to take into account the externalities, the effect on employment and unemployment when you set the minimum wage. And the minimum wage can't solve all the problems in the labor market. It has to be a minimum. As minimum, we tend to focus on the expression minimum wage, the part minimum. Minimum wage does not mean everybody has to be paid at minimum wage. It says the minimum is standard, and then there is a distribution, and people have, and it's desirable that people have a wages above the minimum wage. The problem you have is to, when setting it, you take into account the productivity level and the productivity level of low-skilled people extra, and the impact it has. So on government and market and competition policies, I really want to emphasize that point. As I already said, governments can't do everything in the country. Especially in South Africa, where you have a lot of social needs. You can't be doing all the education investment, all the healthcare education, doing the social grant policies, building infrastructure roads, building housing for all those people, and also creating enterprise, investing in all areas. It would take a century to do that. So what we can do is focus government resources in areas where government impact is determinant, and leverage government money in the other areas to make sure that when you put one rand in some area, you have 2-3 more rand coming from private sectors in this area. And in areas of production of goods and services, not public goods, but other goods and services, it is better to have private sectors taking into care of that and government investing its resources in public goods. So in those goods and services, what is the role of government? We are not saying government has to give everything in the hands of private sector and do nothing. No, we are saying government has to put into place regulation. And where it is needed, an authority, a regulatory authority, which sets what are the objectives, what are the level of investment, the quality of investment. For example, if you come, take an example, the telecommunication. What can be the objective of the government and of a public authority is to have 100% coverage. All parts of the country be covered by 3G or 4G. Would you do that by using government money, given all the other needs, or using private sector money? How can you make sure that the private sector will deliver? They are competing to have a license. They are interested in having Johannesburg, Pretoria, Cape Town, Durban, etc. Not a northern carbon. But you can say, okay, I award you a license, but I give you 5 years, six years, 7 years to have 100% coverage all the country. So they will do so. They will balance. They will, okay, it's not worth doing the north or the areas with a small density of population, but it's worth investing in Cape Town, in Johannesburg, etc. So I will use the extra money I get from this area to have 100% coverage. If not, I will lose my license. You can't do that, and the authority can't start look at the prices, the cost of the producing cost, and say, okay, you can't sell the minimum of the minutes of communication more than that level. To make sure that the population has access at normal prices that guarantees also the benefits for the company. One issue, for example, you have few what we call MVNO, which is retail sellers of telecommunication. So you have the big company, but you have few other companies that buy communication capacity to the big companies that they resell. For example, in France, the post office, they sell communication, but they buy communication capacity from France Telecom, from Orange, and they sell it to individuals. Because the regulator is fixing the selling price of Orange to those people, to those companies that want to enter into the market. And so they can buy some capacity and sell it in the market at a lower price than Orange, because they are targeting different categories and different needs. And that has increased job creation, communication, and decreased the price. That's what we are saying in terms of competition regulation policy. So I think I hope I have gone through most of the questions.
Thank you very much. I think South Africa has gone a long way, and we all agree that this part hasn't been easy. And I think most of the options suggested here have not worked before because of the nature of our nation, of our state, the way we are. Sometimes you introduce private sector to be the one doing such a thing, and then they start lower prices. Time goes on, become higher prices, and our people can't afford to fight. And who has to take the knock at the end of the day? It's the people and its government. And because tomorrow the private sector will come and say, we can't afford to give you this service with the same prices that you have set. And we have to increase because your labor cost is expensive, and then they start, you know, mentioning all the kind of things. At the end of the day, it goes back to the same cycle. But I think, as we said, some of the analysis has to take into consideration the domestic profiles and all that, so that at the end of the day we come up with South African solution based on South African situation, so that at the end of the day, as we compare apples to apples, because I guess some nations are where they are today because they also had to evolve with time from a particular direction to another direction. Let me take this opportunity really to appreciate the presentation, the thinking behind it, the time provided, and also the passion at which it was also presented. I wish we had more time, because we still feel like engaging in further on this matter. This should therefore mark the beginning of our relationship with you, not at that formal level that South Africa should enter into, but rather as informal levels. I think they do assist, because they also generate more questions and more discussions, and I am sure that this discussion will not only end here, it will also continue elsewhere, as we belong to different parties with different ideologies and also different intentions, but directed at the same people. This is what we're all about, unfortunately. the dynamics of state, and that's what we have to do. Can we then leave this here? And thank you very much. I'll appreciate if you can wait for more minutes, if not an hour. So yeah, as we have another engagement with you. Thank you very much, Dr. Paul, Mr. Paul, for your time and the presentation and the responses. May I request that we have just 5 minutes break, and please, members, do come back because we did request for this presentation. The next presenter will be from ILO.
I'm not sure whether men to can I know the woman all the way down here. Yeah. I think the men have to go downstairs. Just follow them. We need to put down. Thank you. him for choosing his card as well. Still ask him. Okay. You wrote that in pen here. The other, where you said no? Yeah. Okay, now we have it. But it's fine. No, no, I've only got the one. I'll get the last one maybe at the end.
Okay.
colleagues. May we reconvene and continue our meeting. I just want to bring to attention the fact that we might finish the meeting around 1:15. That's what we target you to the latest. So be patient with us and remain until the end of the meeting. According to new rules, I now have to report as to whether you were part of the meeting to the end. And that affects your salary package, unfortunately. This is what is agreed, and we have to be there because our meetings have to be attended to. But this is our job. We don't have any other job. We have to be here and do our work. Thank you very much. That was on a lighter note. May we then, without the waste of further waste of time, introduce the next presenter, Ms. Dr. Musa Bayana. Daughter is from the ILO, and I think we've been talking a lot about ILO today. At least we have to get them personally coming here to brief us on work related to minimum wages and so forth, so that you can have a better understanding of what is this animal all about. We talk of decent work. What do we mean by that, and what do they mean? Because they understand that their definition of decent work is the best, because they are in one family with our UN, which is really safeguarding our human rights and interests. So let's give him an opportunity. I know that he wasn't here when I introduced members. May I quickly do so, so that you can then proceed with this presentation. I'll start here. We have Mr. Bikinini, who is a member of this committee, an honorable member, representing the African National Congress. Next to him is Mr. Tiani, also representing the African National Congress. We have the whip of the committee, Mr. Tsele, representing the African National Congress. And then behind him is Dr. Kado, representing the Democratic Alliance, and Mr. Atkinson, representing the Democratic Alliance. I don't know what happened to other members, but I guess they are coming. They are coming back. I know Ms. Matsimbi is not well today. That's why she's so quiet. She's just gone up to see the doctor. Otherwise, we all, Ms. Rantu is coming back. Meg Holman, the chair of the committee. On my right hand side is our support staff, Mayor Belekan, who's also our researcher. And I think you know Peter Paul, our secretary. We have the Department of Economic Development representative of the ministry, actually, both the minister's office and the deputy minister's office here. And then we have my PA there, Benisha Williams. And then people from the PMG. What do you call yourself? Parliamentary Monitoring Group. Yes. So that is the team. May we give you the opportunity, sir?
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, Madam Comer. Thank you, Honorable Members from both sides of the House. Thank you from the Minister and the Minister's Office, the support staff, the PMC. Thank you for having me. So I'm Dr. Sabana from the ILO. And the ILO is a member of the United Nations, and we are particularly touched with issues related to the labor market. I'm quite cognizant of the time and the the competition with the stomach, which is not a competition I can win. So I'll try to put my message across as succinctly as I can. So thank you for the invitation, which required us to talk about the creation of sustainable jobs in South and Southern Africa. Looking at the issues of jobs, skills development, and the way forward, comparing with other developing countries, including Sub-Saharan Africa. So I tried to focus the discussion very much on the brief that I got from the letter. So I didn't want to cover all the issues related to the labor market. Listening to the questions that came, I was more tempted to say maybe I should have come with a different presentation. But I hope I'll also be able to cover some of the issues that has been raised by support from the OECD. The ILO at the global level also was quite a lot with the OECD, so I want to acknowledge a lot of the issues that he has raised. Moving ahead, I want to start with this graph which talks about, I think when we say unemployment in the South African case, we're talking about youth unemployment. And I try to compare with the BRIC countries. This is because, as you may be aware, President Zuma is in China because there's a G20 meeting there. And the ILO were asked to do a paper on this, and I've taken some of this from that paper which has been presented for the G20 labor ministers. What this graph tells us, if you look at the reds, here, I hope it just doesn't show that. The number of young people between the ages of 15 and 24 who are not in school, not in employment, not in any training. And you can see that when you compare with the BRICS, which is that to the extreme left, that is the summary for BRICS. If you compare coming further, you can see Brazil, which for us, the ILO, we like a lot to compare South Africa with Brazil because of obvious reasons of similarity. And then if you look at the Russian Federation, you look at China, and you look at India. So all countries, you can conclude they have a problem, but in the South African case, it's a particularly acute problem. If we move further and try to look at the next graph, percentage of youth, you'll see that the percentage is really highest in South Africa. Also, you have a paper presentation which you can see. What does this say then? If we look historically, so we also have to look at the situation over time. The percentage of young people 15 to 24 has been consistently about 50% unemployment in the period 2010 to 2014. You can see that is the red line there. The percentage of those 15 to 64 is presented in the graph, and this statistic we know because we get it from the statistics through the quarterly level for service every 3 months, and it's hanging between 24-25 and it just reached the 26% mark. If we look at the wider 25 to 34, which is a blue, you can see that it's a much lower percentage, hovering around 20-29%. So what is the result of this? It is then that we have working poor, which is people who earn two-thirds of the median minimum wage, which I think the OECD colleague was already referring to. So that is 33%. So we have people who are working, but they are poor. If we look at excessive hours, we have 21% people who are working more than 48 hours a week. If we look at underemployment, which in the African context, general unemployment is a difficult concept. People working less than 35 hours per week, 4%. The Gini coefficient, we already know that this country competes with Namibia as the most unequal country in the world, having both of them overtaken Brazil in the recent 5 years. And yet, there are a lot of positives that can be drawn out. The World Economic Forum competitiveness rates the country 49th
out of 140, and it is competing for the highest rent, I think, with Mauritius, the final. So that is a positive. Yes, 49 could be better, but it is competitive. That's the very strong institutions in the country, and I think that we know. That there's been a greater focus by the government on green growth. And there's a great focus on the issue of employment in the National Development Plan 2030, so. There's an opportunity to realize the democratic dividends, demographic dividends, as the young people come into the world of work. And this we know from the Asian Tigers, that is one of the key drivers of really what moved the Asian Tigers forward. It's a potential. It has to be exploited. The issue of focusing on disadvantaged groups, youth, women, people living with disabilities, it has a much higher aggregate demand effect on the economy. When we put money in the hands of people who are in these categories, it has a disproportionately higher effect on the economy. So this is a big narrative on the situation, but I think most of us in the room would be familiar with different aspects of this narrative. So we are the ILO. Decent work. It rests on four strategic objectives. The first speaks to rights at work, fundamental principles and rights at work. And that is that everybody in the world of work has rights, has human rights, which are worker rights, and they have to be respected. And that will come back to the issue that was being debated in the room around collective bargaining and the issue of confrontation. But the second pillar is with employment promotion, and that's what largely my presentation was trying to speak to. The third is on social protection. It was already discussed earlier, the issues around social security, the grants. And we are very much working with social development. We are working very much with Department of Labor on how to link the grant system to the social security system, because these are, of course, are two parts of the whole. The fourth and final one is on social dialogue and tripartism. And here I have to say, South Africa is by the ILO, by the 187 member states of the ILO, as a very good example of how dialogue is actually the best and most effective route to addressing labor market turbulence. And in this, we have to talk about the institution of NEDLAC, which we have, as ILO, invested a lot in its formation and in the recent past, in efforts now to resuscitate the efficacy of the institution, along with the other institutions of social dialogue, and the CCMA in particular. So these are, when we say decent work, it speaks to these four areas, right? Employment, social protection, and dialogue. And we say in the ILO that these four objectives are mutually reinforcing, and they're inseparable. So you don't say that we promote decent work only by looking at creating jobs at any level. Sometimes we are listening in this country, and I'm reading a lot the business day, and I've seen some articles there saying, you know what, if we didn't talk about decent work, we'd have many more jobs. Well, we already have 33% of the working poor, people who can't earn a living. I think my colleague from the OECD said 60% income towards only two things, food and transport. Well, from the ILO, we'll add another. Accommodation. If you add accommodation, that percentage goes to 75-80%. So what kind of life is that? If 80% of your money is only for you to eat, to sleep, and so that you can go back and forth to work. And then we say, no, you don't need just jobs. You have to think about quality of those jobs, because you have to think about the stability of society. It's parents, and I live in Pretoria, and we have workers working in Joburg, using the train, coming from Mabopane, Sodanguve. They start work at 7. They have to be at the train at 3 in the morning in order to make the journey to Johannesburg. What quality of life is that? coming back, finish at 5, they get back again, 7, 8, 9. What time would these parents have to socialize with their own children? So what kind of future generation are we creating when children cannot even spend decent time with their own parents? For us, that's what decent work is about, because it speaks to the stability of societies and communities. If work and the imperative of being at work is such that people cannot dispense of their social responsibilities, we create problems in that society. The ILO is so, we are the UN. We are tripartite, both employers, workers, and governments. And maybe at this point I must say, we are a membership-based body. South Africa was a member. They left in 1962, when the pressure on the apartheid regime was too much. They voluntarily left. You then rejoined in 1994. They left in 62 and came back. Since then, the government of South Africa has been a distinguished member of the ILO governing body from 1994 to 2011. Musa, the business unit South Africa, is a member of the ILO governing body through Mr. Mthunzi Mdwala. COSATU through Mr. Begin Challenger is a member of the ILO governing body. And I also say that this year, an international labor conference, we hold an international labor conference every year, where all of the 187 member states come through government employers and workers. And the conference, it was Honorable Minister Mildred Oliver, who had the distinguished honor of being the president of the conference this year, on behalf of South Africa, on behalf of SADC, and on behalf of Africa. So that is a major recognition. Why am I saying this? To say that for us, the ILO, South Africa is a key member and is a very active member. And therefore, what we do is with and through the government, the employers and workers in this country. And you'll see why this is important. In the work we do in the country then, and I come to this issue, I'm coming only to this block on promoting sustainable jobs. So I'm not summarizing all the work that the ILO does and that. I'm tempted to touch on some of the issues that arose in this discussion. But when we look at the issue of promoting sustainable jobs, so first of all, we underline the issue sustainable in the context of that short narrative I gave earlier. We have four pillars. The first is to look at the comprehensive employment policy framework. In most countries, we work through developing national employment policy, which tries to bring all the sectoral and national policies together to see how do they impact on the employment equation. And in most cases, we then support the country to produce a standalone document that speaks to employment. In this country, we are not yet there. It's thought by the national authorities to go in this direction, but we have made a lot of substantive input into the National Development Plan 2030, and you'll see that a lot of the dialogue in the background section there speaks to the issues between growth and jobs and the concerns thereof. We support the issues of macroeconomic and fiscal management. They are particularly key. We are very clear that if there is no economic growth, the job market becomes very difficult. And this we saw during the global financial crisis. So the issues of macroeconomic stability and prudent fiscal management are particularly key. But we will say the focus must be on jobs. The focus must be on employment. At the ILO, we have for a long time been arguing against what has generally been called the Washington Consensus. That, you know what, get the macroeconomic fundamentals right, get the exchange rates, current account deficit, everything else will take care of itself. I think the world is wiser now. It doesn't take care of itself. And when employment is not taken care of, you end up, as we have seen, in some cases, let's say North Africa, the Arab Spring. So you can take care of macroeconomic situation, you can take care of fiscal policy, but if you don't put a deliberate policy objective on employment and the impact on employment and how to promote employment as an imperative at that level, you still can end up with social upheaval, as we have seen. Sectoral and industrial policies for inclusive structural transformation. So we are quite clear as the ILO that sectoral and industrial policies must, as one of their objectives, have the issue of transformation. If you do not transform, and we are speaking specifically in the South African context, the issue of transformation, it's not a choice, it's an imperative. You don't transform, eventually the conflict in society will make the place, the country and the economy an unattractive investment destination. And I dare say, we have worked with, in some respects, on the industrial policy action plan, IPAP, with economic development, and we are always at the sense of saying, how do we ensure that sectoral and industrial growth brings a transformative agenda into the income distribution? It is for that reason that we have worked very closely with authorities on the issue of minimum wage. I chaired the first interview with the Vice President held at in Rosenk on minimum wage, in which we brought experts from Germany, Britain, the Equal Pay Commission in Germany, Malaysia, Brazil, Argentina, to Latin America, to dialogue on the issue of minimum wage. I think it is after that that the government decided we must introduce a minimum wage. The issue of amount, which has been talked about, is a national decision. The task force that has been formed now, the panel of seven people, has as one of the eight members an ILO expert based in Geneva, who is an expert only on minimum wages, advising that panel. But we are very clear that the decision on where you particularly set that amount, I want to underline not minimum wage, because you already have a minimum wage setting mechanism. You have a very good and robust sectoral collective bargaining system. It's about a national minimum wage. And those two things are related but different. How do you transition from sectoral-based collective bargaining, and how does it live juxtaposed with a national minimum wage? And that is a debate that I think is currently being had. And how, where do you set then the wage? And the issues of how high and how low, those are issues that the national negotiators on both sides have to work on, and we are really left to the choices that they're having to make and their impact on employment creation in the future. But we say evidence shows, and we've done studies, and that is why we brought the executive secretary of the Equal Pay Commission from the UK. Germany in 2014 introduced the national minimum wage. We brought the professor managing that process. Yes. And in all the cases, Latin America has been there already for a much longer time. Asia is only catching up, and we brought experts from all the sides, also national authorities. And they were clear that there is a much greater fear before our job losses than the reality after. Of the seven countries we brought, two of which were European, three Asian, and three Latin American, they could not show evidence of job loss after the introduction of the minimum wage. And therefore that says the debate is protracted, it's difficult, but in all cases we don't have massive job losses as is largely feared in this country. It depends, of course, what they choose as final amount. The issue of labor market policy, active labor market policies, and here we have to talk about the expanded public works program. We are working with the National Department of Public Works. We have two specialists based in Pretoria, the headquarters. We have colleagues working based in the National Department of Provincial, National Public Works Provincial offices in the Eastern Cape, in KZN, and in Limpopo. And I start working there to assist the authorities in this area of the expanded public works program. And the main issue for us is to assist the authorities to link the top opportunities created by expanded public works programs to be towards decent work. And this is two pillars. One is, how do we ensure that the people who are accessing these job opportunities access tertiary education, access skills training in the areas in which they are working in. In this regard, we are working for the first time now, the provincial department in Limpopo is creating a training center focused specifically on assisting beneficiaries of expanded public works opportunities in how to equip them so that they end up with NQF level 5 qualification. Because we say if the people access these opportunities, and by and large the majority of those are people with very limited levels of education, most of them have probably not finished matric. You will know, of course, that piggyback on that discussion of primary education, that 48% the studies show of people who start grade 1, most 48% thereabout don't finish grade 5. And the question is, how do you then cater for those people into the labor market? How do you bring them into the labor market? And this issue of expanded public works, particularly helping the majority of such young people and then equipping them, linking them to access to skills training, is, we think, a very good policy initiative that needs to be upheld. The other element is the issue of public employment services. We are working with the Department of Labor first to do an analysis of the blockages and challenges around public employment services. We actually were finalizing the terms of reference this week, and I think in October we are fielding a mission from Geneva to assist in looking at how public employment services are actually working. Another element that links to the issue of the link between public employment services and private employment services, and that we are also working on bringing greater partnership. You may be aware, of course, that you yourselves, Parliament, have recently passed the Employment Services Bill, which compels private employment agencies to work much more in partnership with public employment services, and in fact introduces a fee-based mechanism which can create funds for how to manage the relationship between public and private employment services. And this is, from my experience, how it is all over the world. These are not normally two parallel systems. These are systems that have to work hand in hand with each other. And let me link a little bit to the discussion earlier by my colleague from OECD on this issue of electricity, the independent versus the national provider, ESCOM versus the independent producers. In public employment services, it is also a bit like that. You will always have in most countries public employment services, but it should be complemented rather than competing with private employment agents. Then you need a regulatory system. And the Public Employment Services Bill that passed last year creates this framework, and we're now working with the Department of Labor to put this into practice. On sustainable enterprise programs, they come to a lower macro level. The issue of creating an enabling environment for sustainable enterprises and employment is particularly key. We are working with, and I want to acknowledge that partnership with the Department of Small Business Development, and I'll give more detail on that, on this issue of creating an enabling environment. And we, from our studies, and I think most people studying international development in this country agree, the main challenge is actually at the local level, the municipal level. The environment that is most affecting and binding to enterprises, SMEs, SMMEs, is the municipal level. It's at the lower level. And as you may be aware, the authorities have started with a lot of pilot support. We've brought international expertise in this area on how to create an enabling environment at the municipal level through the reduction of red tape. So the national authorities are now rolling out a nationwide red tape program to do an assessment of the environment at a local level and how to address the challenges of municipal bylaws. Promoting sustainable and responsible workplaces, I circulated the report there just to show on tourism, something we've worked on, to assist in improving not only the productivity of enterprises but also the working conditions. So how do we ensure tourism is one of the eight key sectors, priority sectors in this country, and it is obviously a growth sector, but how do we ensure that the employment impact in that sector can be increased? And we have a program that has worked very well both with private but also with SAPAS and the provincial parts that are managed by the provincial authorities. Support entrepreneurship and business development, because at the end of the day, I think studies show globally, 80-90% of businesses are created in SMEs rather than big large firms globally. And so how the SME sector is performing is a key determinant of the employment outcomes. And so how do we promote entrepreneurship? How do we promote business development to ensure that the SMEs that are there survive? You know, studies tell us that 75% of this country of all SMEs die within the first 2.5 to 3 years of creation. And the question is why? One key factor, of course, has to do with the environment at the municipal level. But the other has to do with the entrepreneurial abilities. Less the appetite they may want, but the ability and the business development capabilities. And that speaks to the managerial abilities of the people who are creating the entrepreneurs and running them in a responsible manner. And in this regard, we are working with the state institutions, SEFA, SEDA, and so on. Skills. The issue of linking formal education systems with the labor market is a major challenge. The transition from the education system to labor to the labor market, and in this regard, the CEF systems, the approach now taken by government and the FET colleges, we think is absolutely critical. That was a gap that was missing. Equipping young people with technical skills in woodwork, carpentry, plumbing, welding, this kind of everyday skills. That gap was there. These facilities probably need to be expanded, made much more accessible. We think that there is probably a very high focus on university education, and yes, it's very necessary, but the reality is the majority of people are not going to university. They need a skill without having to go to university. And we think that there is need for a greater balance to shift and focus. And we think Minister Zuman is in the right area in saying, let us just pay attention to university and all its difficulties, but we need an equal attention to where actually the majority of young people actually end up at, which is the TVET colleges. And that is a much more efficient and quicker transmission mechanism for people into the labor market. There's a much greater need to look at apprentices. Globally, these have been proven to be a very effective tool, and in this country, I think the reach of apprenticeships is too limited. I'm sorry that Honorable Madam left about skills recognition and accreditation of prior learning. In this country, it is true that in the absence of proper, well-resourced and very robust TVET colleges, technical vocational education systems, the people go into work and acquire skill on the job. But if you look on the certificate, they have nothing. But if you put them on the job, they can get the job done very well. So we have worked with the National Skills Authority, with the Department of Education, on a skills recognition and accreditation system. And that the government is now starting to work on rolling out in a much more robust way. But that, of course, for that system to work efficiently, you need a massive network of technical vocational education colleges where the testing and the upgrading can be done. And you need also an apprenticeship scheme which can be linked to that testing and upgrading. And this area, we think, requires much more attention and dialogue. If you are in this country and reading papers, you think that every young person is actually going to university. But the reality is the percentage of young people going to university is very low, maybe around 15%. So what happens to all those other young people? And we think this dialogue needs to balance. The issue of employability and soft skills. The education system, we feel, needs also take into account preparing young people for the world of work by giving them these soft skills, by giving them how to be a responsible person in the workplace, by preparing them how to prepare for interviews. In my workplace, if I give an example, I'm always given in the end, these are the three people, we advertise a job, you get 2,000, 3,000 applications, in the end, they are whittled down, you end up with these three young people. And the preparation that those young people have, how do you conduct an interview? I'm looking, how do I choose? How are they prepared for an interview? And it's something that the schooling system is talking about. Quite often you ask them basic questions on, so what's the ILO? What's the UN? And they're having to think and say, did you read? Did you prepare? But you can see it's not the young people's fault. The training that they were given when they are at matric, and I have a son at matric at St. Albans in Pretoria, are they trained? You are now going to go out there. Do you know how to conduct yourself in an interview? How do you sit? How do you prepare? How do you sit like this? And I think these are the soft skills that we are talking about to facilitate this transition from school to work. What about those in the rural areas? That speaks to the last point. But there are two areas that I want to also highlight in this regard. 28% of people in the workplace in this country are in the informal economy. We've done a study on that. We've worked with the authorities on the issue of transition to formality, from informal to formality. But that is when we talk about defining formality as people who are undertaking an enterprise that is not fully registered or is registered in some way because they are shadow formalities. But there's also, of course, the increasing reality that people who used to be in regular jobs are now finding themselves in a formal workplace, but in an informal employment relationship. And this speaks to that issue that we call atypical employment relationship, the triangular relationship. That speaks to what people commonly call labor brokers. And that in itself is also now a major challenge, because that is the casualization issue where people no longer have security of contracts, and there is no clear attribution of responsibility between the recruiting firm and the workplace where they are working. That's an issue that we are also working with authorities on. The issue of green jobs, the green economy is a reality. Efforts have been made in this regard, I think, to make this a clear job creation area, to look at how to green the economy much better. And that we can only encourage. We think that to tackle the environment challenge in this country, we need, I hear the chair person saying something, we need, I'm just looking at the time, we need new sectors. So the green economy is one, the blue economy with the oceans is another, and it is in this area that we think that real value addition in terms of the job creation equation can really be made. But we think that it should be a very clear imperative as these sectors are being promoted. Otherwise, their ability to attract the TBT colleges come back again. How do we prepare jobs for people who want to go into the green economy? How to prepare young people for jobs? Young people want to go into the blue economy, into the ocean economy. In the interest of time, we look at, I was just trying to summarize all of this. And for us, the approach is always with and through dialogue with the government, with the employers, with the worker in the country. So as ILO, we come and embed ourselves in the country, we work with the authorities, we always work at the invitation of the authorities, and we always do this wherever we go. We bring the employers on the table, we bring the workers on the table for dialogue. So the issue of job rich growth, the issue of sustainable enterprises, formalization of the informal economy and skills, these are within what we call the Decent Work Country Program for South Africa, which was signed for at NED like in 2011. And it informs the work that we are doing. A lot of these issues I've already covered. Let me, on minimum wage, I've already spoken on that. We are working on a national youth policy. We've been asked by the Deputy President's office to work to assist the country on a national youth policy to amalgamate the different policies that are there. And one of the key elements, of course, in looking at the issues of youth policy is this issue of the employment element. Expanded public works program, I've already spoken to that. Active labor market. Let me talk about a little bit about the tax, the employment tax incentive scheme. If you recall, when it was introduced, it was very much contested, understandably by the unions particularly. There was a much greater fear of the displacement effect of older workers. Well, 5 years later, I think the reports bear out that, by and large, there was a report which came out, I think, in the past 2 weeks by Treasury. It has been a success. I think 683,000 young people have been better absorbed. And it shows that 80% of those young people are actually retained after the 3-year period by the employer. And on the other hand, up to so far, there's not been a report on the issue of the displacement effect other than natural attrition for those who are retired. It tells us that when we take bold measures to try innovative ideas on how to tackle the youth employment issue, sometimes we are rewarded with success. The challenge for us then, Madam Chair, is to upscale. How do we upscale this program? If there are actually transgressions, I think the unions have not yet said this, and ILO, one of the ways in which we work is if the COSATU would come to us and they would require an international consultant to work with a local consultant to look at the displacement effects over the past 5 years, we'll be happy to do. The fact that they have not come must mean that either it's not a very big issue right now, or they realize the fear that was there has not been borne out by reality. So in all of this, Madam Chair, what we see is we have to move from experimentation to upscaling so that it becomes a much wider national program. We feel that there are many programs that are there trying to tackle employment in different ways, but they roll out at the national level in a very intensive way, sector by sector in a specific way, could assist us to address, if you recall, that tall red line that we started with, which is really way out of line with all the BRICS comparisons. Towards the end, we have a lot of programs then that we are working with the national authorities, employers and workers in different sectors. A key one that I want to highlight, yes, we have on SMEs, the first one. We're working there in, and the documents that you have before you give all the details, so I don't want to spend too much time on that. But we give policy advice based on projects that we work with at a very micro level, so that we see what are the realities, what are the challenges. And in all our projects, we're always working with employers, with the workers, so that when we come up to policy level, it is informed by the reality on the ground. And that is why we always articulate national policy advice, international expertise, but all of it very much grounded on the reality on the ground. So the first project we're working in Free State and KZN. The second project we're working on KZN, Free State, Eastern Cape, on the social economy. And this is again another area that we think a lot of experimentation has been done, but it offers, particularly in rural communities, a great opportunity for much better employment effects. We thank National Treasury for now looking on the basis of findings from this project at the procurement legislation, so that it can be much more willing and allowing of cooperatives, of women-owned businesses, of SMEs, particularly in the rural settings, to provide services not only to government but also to the big companies and make it compelling in the areas in which these businesses are working, so that that divide between a rural economy and an urban economy is reached. The focus on our competitive enterprises, there's no reason, the documentation is there, we think it has been likely very successful, but we're now working also in the automotive sector. We know that the automotive sector in this country is largely a result of very robust government intervention. We're always intrigued sometimes when we have this debate about the role of government, and we say, why don't we just look at the reality, the examples that are down the ground. The automotive sector, I would say, if it was not for the strong commitment by the authorities, that sector would not be there. We know that there was a sector in Australia, and those who follow this story know that in the past 2 years, that sector, the automotive sector in Australia, largely collapsed because the support by the authorities has not been forthcoming. And that when the Australians advised on how to design the automotive sector in the country, the country chose to go with a model that was much more, let's say, offering more incentives, more intervention to build that sector. And we know right now there is 550,000 new vehicles assembled and manufactured in this country every year. With the new program that has been put there now, they are looking at growing that by 2020 to 1.2 million. So clearly, jobs are created in growth sectors like this. We know that Mercedes-Benz and BMW, right-hand vehicles worldwide, are now assembled in this country. The question, however, is then, what are the mechanisms we're putting in place back against the skills to ensure that we equip young people to be able to work effectively in the automotive sector as the sector tries to grow from 500,000 to 1.2 million vehicles a year. We're working also with the ports because it's clear that the ports are a key part of the infrastructure for economic development. Their efficiency and effectiveness is particularly crucial. How to achieve the turnaround time there of the bulk cargo that comes through so that it moves through quickly there, and we're in a partnership with the Belgians, with Antwerp, to assist particularly Durban and Richards Bay, and I think also in Eastern Cape, to move this through. There are a lot of details here that I could show you on the issues that I've touched on. That's why I'm just flipping through this. I think you have the PowerPoint with you. I just want to end on this note. Employment must be an explicit policy objective. It's less effective when it's a derivative, when it is, as they used to call it, trickle-down theory. So most countries are now developing an employment policy and looking at every policy in the prism of what is its impact on employment. Most countries in the sub-region are doing it. Globally, the BRICS competitors, the BRICS that are South Africa's companions, all of them have national employment policies. And so we think a need for a consolidated, holistic dialogue on employment is particularly key. The issue of employment mainstreaming in all policy areas is, we think, something that needs to be looked at. There is dialogue in this country on employment, but that employment mainstreaming in each and every policy that is passed by the authorities, we still think is lacking. As I know, we can assist you, and we have projects that try to assist you to show you good practice, but also to develop good practices from the country. And I've speculated on the social economy. South Africa, I think, is one of the leading countries on the issues of the social economy, and we have described this there. Therefore, there are a number of employment challenges, but there are opportunities. What is required is the commitment, but also the ability to exploit those commitments. As ILO, we have a long history. We are almost 100 years old in the next 3 years. So we have been in this area for a long time. We are happy for the partnership with authorities and discussion. And a lot that is already working. We are surprised at ILO on the narrative of this country, which largely borders on the negative. Maybe it's in your national psyche, we don't know. But for us as the ILO, we work with you on an everyday basis. We see, yes, the challenges that you face, but we also see some of the areas where, like the automotive sector, you support sectors. Now you are in the green economy, you are the ocean economy, the green economy, areas where there are good examples. We are always surprised why those are not also raised as much as they should. I want to end on this note of collective bargaining. That is an area I would welcome if I was given a second chance to come and talk only about collective bargaining. But we are the ILO, we are the ones who have the conventions, and we are the ones who have helped you to put a system in place. And we say that for the narrative on strikes, and we agree when they happen, they're very confrontational, and I'll come to that. But the reality is that in the year 2014, we did this, I think, there were 14 strikes, but there were 283 settlements that did not go to strike. So why is it that when we talk about this, we only talk about the 14 and not the 283 that were successful? And that's, for us, coming from an international, it's very surprising. We agree we have to deal with the troubles that lead to the 14. First of all, we think it has to do with the capacity of the negotiators on both sides. The issue of inequality and inequality is particularly key, particularly when those that benefit have benefited and continue to benefit are one group, and those that do not have are another group. It creates a tension there, and that's a historical fact. So when you ask, why are the collective bargaining system so confrontational, where we say, just look at the history, you shouldn't even ask this question, it's obvious. Until color ceases to be the determinant of who has a lot of money and who is poor, that confrontation will continue. Until the inclusive approach, until collective bargaining is not only for those at the lower end of the employment spectrum, if we say executive pay, and we have, there's a book on executive pay in South Africa, and I'm happy to share that with you. If you look at executive pay and how it is settled, largely above 10-12%, no dialogue. If you look at collective bargaining, very contested, largely 11% and below. That is the basis for the confrontation in the collective bargaining system for those at the bottom, because that's not the collective bargaining system for those at the upper end. Let me end on this note, and I thank you very much for having us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sabayana. That was a mouthful. I guess we want to thank you really for your understanding, especially in relation to the time allocation to your presentation. We needed the whole day for those two presentations. Unfortunately, the program, the legislature, doesn't allow us to do so. However, we really want to appreciate this. The issues raised also quite provocative at some stage. I think we'll need to look at some of those issues in detail.
so that you are able to understand them vis-à-vis the earlier presentation, so that when we look at the two, we are able also to balance that South Africa is on another trajectory, and we need to understand that and be able then to put things into its own horizon. So, colleagues, this is the presentation. I did indicate earlier that we have until 4:15 because 2:00 is the talk. We need to give you time to have something to eat. Can you engage on the presentation? Okay, that's right. And that is then. Any other? Okay. That was very clear.
Thank you very much.
Issues of stomach, of the stomach.
Stomach politics. Stomach. Thank you very much, Chair. We want to thank Dr. Musa Bayana for a very professional presentation. But the first thing that I would like to say, Chair, about this presentation is that I've been looking at, the doctor's policy. I'm looking at his qualifications. You know, that should serve as an inspiration to our people, those employed and those unemployed, because education really can assist us to get ourselves out of the rut that we are in. So we need more like you. And, you know, we ourselves as legislators, we should also be inspired so that we, even though we know it's very difficult, but we need to push, you know, and get some of those qualifications. The first question there, Jefferson, is on the Extended Public Works Program. The ILO study is very correct. They see the EPWP very progressively. They say this is an opportunity. You see, the young people that we say are unemployable, they are in millions. For us to, to scale these young people, it is going to take us a very long time. So the EPWP is giving us an opportunity to train them. As they go in there are certain skills that are given to these young people and preparing them for better opportunities in the past. Now the thing is, Doctor, some political parties in South Africa have been very much vehemently opposed to the concept of EPWP. They've been attacking government on the basis that these are not permanent jobs. These are not permanent jobs. But when the concept came into being, everybody knew that there were not going to be permanent jobs. But as you correctly point out in the presentation, this do provide an opportunity to expose these young people to some kind of work experience, some kind of training, which makes them better people in the future. Would you agree with some of our political parties who are taking this view that this is out of order, or do you think they're going to the extremes in trying to play the role of opposition? Because sometimes parties in government, in democracy, sometimes they need to work together to get the country to work. You should not oppose everything that government is doing. That's the first question. The second one, Doctor, it's about the people that have been migrating, moving from country to country. Historically in South Africa, we've always had workers from the rest of Africa coming to work in the mines and everywhere. You know, our people from the rest of Africa, they've played a major role in building the economy in our country. And we've always seen that positively. But given that, given the economic problems that the world is now exposed to now, when some of these people come to South Africa, it is seen negatively by some sectors of our people. Sometimes it leads to xenophobia and so on. What is the ILO doing in the rest of the continent to try and help those countries to create jobs and so on, so that it has no longer become necessary for them to come in big numbers. Not that they are not welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I apologize for getting in and out of the meeting. I just wanted to check, as I look at this, I'm not sure this information will I get maybe in one of these books, but I wanted to check the employment rate of people coming from other African countries in South Africa versus the unemployment rate of our own maybe students or own people that are in Africa. Do they have that information, and can Mr. Doctor, can you share it with us? And maybe in sharing that information with us, can you give us reasons maybe beyond the employment rate of people coming from other countries and the unemployment of our own people here in South Africa, especially the young ones?
I thought you wanted to say that, because earlier on you said Africa was a bit on the said South Africa. Yes. Babu, beginning sense now.
No, thanks, Chair. I think, Chair, it was very happy with the presentation itself, Chair. But I think it would be improper not to raise any issue. You see, there are issues that you're talking about, which we, in terms of transformation, we are correct, quite convinced about your argument. But you see, in these provinces, obviously, of South Africa, we have goals that are very good on automobile sector, which they create jobs and all of that. But we are quiet on those that are rural in nature, where they depend, because I think the food market can really better serve our country well than others through use of the land and other stuff. I think we are not exploiting that opportunity in South Africa. So I wanted to raise that particular point to say it would be very good that this mix of regions. You know, if you are here in Cape Town, moving around in Cape Town, you see that the job opportunity, people that are working here, we call them that, we call ourselves some blacks, but they are all of them are foreigners. So in terms of the equity, now we are not all aware. If you go to a hotel, you go to Karaj, you go any place, you don't get us there in that space. So I think it will be very proper to put things other times in perspective, so that we're able to help our country to yield a better result for transmission. Thank you very much. Instead of undermining others.
Thanks, Babu. In the interest of time, I'm not going to ask questions, but I'm going to allow Dr. to respond.
Thank you very much. Understanding the competition of the stomach, which is unwinnable, I want to start by acknowledging the importance of education, and to say I wouldn't be sitting in this chair if it was not for application and education. So my family, my father, but also my own personal application. And I think that is a part of the story that in this country you don't hear too often. The role of the family in supporting young people improve themselves. I don't want to say more, but I think that is a critical issue. The Expanded Public Works Program, active labor market policies are a global phenomenon. It's a concept accepted, and I'm sure my colleague from the OECD could also talk about it. All countries in the world use, at some point or other, active labor market policies to intervene when the economy is not performing well and the job effects are very much in the negative. Then public authorities come up with normally temporary interventions to try to carry the country forward until the economy begins to pick up. Now, in a situation where the global economy is hovering around 1-2%,
in a situation where economic growth in this country is continually stuck below 2%, we know that it needs to grow 5-7% for it to be able to create the jobs. And therefore, there is space for active labor market policies at a conceptual level. So EPWP is not a creation only of this country. India ran an EPWP program that is in fact much bigger than the one in this country. And it is an opportunity to bring young people, particularly those at the lower levels, yes. The idea is not that these are permanent jobs. These are transitional mechanisms where the key is in the design to ensure that the skills acquired are then properly registered with the national skills authorities so that it facilitates an easy and smoother transition into the world of work. But that is where the link that we are trying to work with authorities on access then to public and private employment services should be. So that we say, if you are in Northern Cape, you have benefited from EPWP program and you are able to then get a certification in that area. A company in Northern Cape, once it has an opening, it must be compelled to first of all look at the public and private employment services databases to take those people into the job market. This is standard design that most countries are doing everywhere. So I agree completely with you that it needs to be looked at, it needs to be sharpened, but that in itself as a concept, it is acceptable. One can have issues around this implementation in certain localities, I don't know, that could be looked at, but to question the concept itself, we think is misplaced, especially in a situation where the economy is not growing. Labor migration, economic benefits, I want to acknowledge my colleague from the OECD. We are actually doing a study now, which is going to start, I hope he is aware, on the economic benefits of labor migration in this country with the OECD. So the issue, we're trying to balance the negativity to show also the contribution of labor migration, which we rightly acknowledge. The negative side is that Greece, in a situation where the economy is not performing well, in a situation where unemployment is very high, it becomes difficult then for the people, understandably in the communities, to understand how do we have foreigners who end up dominating the retail sector, who end up dominating the restaurants. It is a challenge, indeed. But we would say, go back to the skill question. What are the skills that are being prepared by young people to be able to compete in those restaurants? What are the training colleges that are equipping waiters and bar people? We think that gap, that absence of skills, of a robust skills equipping national program at this middle level, not at that higher level, is where the gap is. When those foreigners come, they are coming probably from hotel schools where they've been trained these things. The employer sees the two is able to get. That's one part. But the other part is again discrimination. Because their resident status is irregular most often, because there are issues around how people move in and out of the country because of the border management systems, but also because of the excessive security focus of migration. And we are talking to the Department of Home Affairs. We are aware that they now have a green paper which is open for comment until the end of this year. We've worked with them on 5 colloquiums where at the beginning when we went to say this message, that you know what, migrant workers have rights like everybody else. We looked at it like we're from another planet, but I'm happy that they've now come much further. But we say the issue of managing migration in and out is not only an in issue. Because now South Africa, because thanks to all the companies that are going into the African continent, you actually have a lot of South Africans working in other countries. So how your migration system is designed must look both in but also out. I think the ongoing debate by Home Affairs is now very useful. We are also working with Department of Labor on this issue of migration. I would be happy to come back for a discussion on migration. This issue of employment of foreigners and the reasons why. I think we need another session on it. The issue of agriculture, completely agreed. We think it's underplayed. We think the challenges we are facing around taking the land, if I could use it that way, is a missed opportunity in how agriculture can become also a big employer. It currently is, but it's clear that the numbers are actually declining, not increasing in agriculture. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr.
I think it is very important that we appreciate this your being here and presentation that you've given us, and also say that this should also be the beginning of our relationship as this team, Economic Development and Israel. Just like what you said to OECD, we hope that we don't end here. We are going to be extending more invitations to you, because now we have an understanding of who you really are, what issues are you dealing with, and where can we capitalize on your expertise so that we are able to be more enriched with information related to the work that you do. As this team, we really want to appreciate your coming here. The fact that you are based in South Africa is an added bonus to us, because we're going to be traveling a lot, unlike Mr. Paul, who's far away. But that doesn't mean we cannot communicate, and where possible, re-invite you to come here again. This then marks the end of our engagement, and the meeting is adjourned.
One second. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.